This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Knowledgeable.
Listen, here's what's wrong with your hypothesis, your theorem, your supposition, your postulate.
Honest.
If that front ain't in gangsta, your back end won't be able to show its full potential.
Understanding.
You're going to suck. You're going to suck for the next couple of years.
Passionate.
I'm all over social media. I live it.
This is the Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980 and the Odyssey app.
Hashtag facts.
It's the Kevin Sheehan Show. Now, here's Kevin.
Orloff gets over there to play. Move it on for Backstrom. Oshie to the trailer. Manthoff the head fake. Fires! He scores! Ahem. I think I said lethal.
He's having fun. And the Caps bench went crazy when he snapped that baby. They'll get that puck. He's got a double puck night.
Yeah, not a bad debut for a guy that had been traded 24 hours earlier to your Washington Capitals, who've put together 2 games in a row against the Bruins and Flyers in which they've outscored their opponents 14-2. Good morning, everybody. Joe Beninati will join us at about 7:30-ish this morning, and we will talk to him. He was on the call last night, obviously, with Locker in the Caps win over the Flyers, which included the debut of the guy they just traded for, Anthony Mantha. They gave up Verana, they gave up Panic, they gave up some draft choices. And in his first game, and you suggested yesterday, because they had played in Carolina, that he might be there for the morning skate, and we talked yesterday with Tarik El-Bashir. He wouldn't have been surprised if Mantha had made his debut last night. He didn't. He had an assist. He had a goal. They were off to the races. But really what's impressive is just the last 2 nights beating up on 2 teams by the combined score of 14-1. And now they get the weak Sabres tonight. Again, Joe Beninati this morning at around 7:30, 7:40, somewhere around there. We'll talk to Joe. Fred Smoot scheduled to join the program at 8 a.m., I asked him if he would be available at 8 a.m. I never stop going back to the well. You cannot deter me. You cannot get me off track if I like somebody, despite Freddie last time sleeping right through our scheduled appearance. Fred said he'll be up at 8 a.m. I do want to get his thoughts on the draft and on this new tight end. Man, I'll tell you what, there was some excitement in Washington Football Team Nation yesterday. Samis Reyes, a Chilean-born athlete, wanted to play in the NBA, went to Tulane, played basketball for a couple of years, and now got into this international gateway or player pathway program where the league initiates player international athletes to train for the NFL. Well, he had an outstanding pro day at Florida's pro day. If you're a Washington Football Team fan and you haven't seen the Pro Day highlights, you must have been locked in a cave yesterday, because my God, were those making the rounds on social media. I think it's very possible we just got Antonio Gates yesterday. Actually, we didn't, and I'll explain that a little bit later on in this hour. Also on the show today, very much looking forward to speaking with Dane Brugler. Dane is one of the really strong draftaholics as Jeffrey Lurie was described in the story about the Eagles. But really, he's one of the really good draft experts out there. He just finished producing his draft guide, the 2021 draft guide, where he has literally reviewed 636 prospects and ranked them. Dane's been on the show before. He will join us later on this morning at 8:30, and we will go through all the possibilities, not only for Washington, but I still think the most intriguing part of this draft is the early portion of the draft and what the 49ers will do. This is, you know, Kuiper came out yesterday with his mock draft version, whatever it is at this point. Might be version 3. I don't know. It could be version 4. Two rounds. We talked about it at the very end of the show. And he is absolutely adamant that the 49ers traded up for Mac Jones. And I watched a lot of him yesterday on the various ESPN programs that he was on after releasing this latest version of the mock draft. And really, this conversation about what San Francisco does at 3 is really the most fascinating conversation of the first round, because it will really dictate what happens at least over the next 15 selections. When you get to New England at 15. I still think, Brendan, that Washington's not in position without giving up so much more than other teams that will have more attractive offers, more likely than not. You know, Denver would have a more attractive offer. New England would have a more attractive offer to move up to number 4 with the Falcons, or to number 7 with Detroit, or to number 8 with Carolina. I still think that the chances that Washington trades up to draft their quarterback of the future, whether it would be Trey Lance or Justin Fields or Mac Jones, one of those three is going to be within striking distance, more likely than not. Striking distance meaning from 4 through 8 in that range for a blockbuster offer. But Washington's offer, because of where they pick at 19, would have to be significantly better than the teams that are more likely to be thinking about jumping up, Denver and New England among those teams. We'll get into Kuiper's draft, latest mock draft, a little bit more, because Davis Mills, as we talked about at the end of the show, is the second round selection to Washington, and he is very much in Kuiper's opinion, and I listened to a lot of Kuiper yesterday, he is very much in Kuiper's view, not only his sixth quarterback, but he believes that a lot of teams now are dropping Kellen Mond and are dropping Kyle Trask and moving Davis Mills up. The funny thing about watching highlights of Mills is he plays with a knee brace, and man, does he look immobile. But apparently he's not. But he looks more of the traditional pocket passing process, get it out quickly kind of guy than he does playmakers. Anyway, more time to get to that. I wanted to start with this. What do you got?
All right.
What do you got?
So I saw this story in the Washington Post this morning. Paul Laduca, who's been around the block for a lot of different reasons in baseball, made an accusation on a podcast in 2019 about longtime Major League Baseball umpire Joe West. Yesterday, the culmination of a long trial and a lawsuit that West put against Laduca came to a conclusion, and West was awarded $500,000 plus interest by the New York Supreme Court in what was a defamation lawsuit against Laduca. Here's what Laduca said on a podcast back in 2019. On the Action Network. He claims that as a player, they were playing a really tight game against the Phillies, and Billy Wagner came in from the bullpen. Laduca was the catcher at the time. He said as follows. He said, quote, "I used to go to the mound every time and be like, well, what's going on? And he's like, well, hey, Joe's behind the plate. Set up a couple of more inches inside. Laduca said, I was like, are you kidding me? Joe hates me. He's like, no. Joe loves me. Talking about Billy Wagner explaining to Laduca, no. Joe West loves me. He's going to give me a more liberal strike zone. Laduca responded during this game in 2019. He hasn't given us the corner all day. And Wagner said, don't worry about it. And Laduca then went on to say he literally throws 10 pitches and strikes out three guys. Joe rang up all three guys. Eight out of the nine pitches were at least 3 to 4 inches inside, not even close. Guys were throwing bats and everything. Joe walks off the field. I get back into the clubhouse, and I'm like, what the blank just happened out there? And Whit Wagner winked at me and said, he said, Joe loves antique cars, so every time he comes into town, I lend him my 57 Chevy so he can drive it around, and so then he opens up the strike zone for me. West was infuriated at the claims on this podcast in 2019, saying it never happened, and he filed a lawsuit saying the story was completely made up and really alleging that the comments could damage his chances of being voted into the Hall of Fame. West has been a longtime umpire, as many of you know, and has a chance to eventually get voted into the Hall of Fame. According to this lawsuit, and I didn't realize this, a Hall of Fame election for an umpire can mean at least $250,000 a year in appearances. The 68-year-old, as it turns out, Joe West umpired only once when Wagner and Laduca were teammates in 2006 and 2007. And Wagner didn't even pitch in the game. So Laduca made up the entire story. And yesterday, a court, because of that, because of the proof that West had never even worked a game in which Wagner and Laduca were teammates and Wagner pitched, he was awarded $500,000. It turned out to be $250,000 for past mental anguish and emotional distress, and another $250,000 as compensation for expenses he'll need to incur in retaining a PR firm to formulate and operationalize a sufficient reputation remediation plan. These podcasts, man, you hear it all the time. So when you, and I listen to a lot of podcasts now. In part, I didn't, well, I'll be honest with you. 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, whenever it was that I launched my podcast, I really was unfamiliar with podcasts. And so were a lot of you. And many of you that were much younger were listening to a lot of podcasts. Now I listen to a lot of podcasts. And you hear a lot of crazy stories on podcasts. Ones where you're like, really? I wonder if that even happened. And I think people get on these podcasts and they assume that nobody's listening. It's weird that way. You are much more sort of open to thinking that it's just you and the mic and your guest and that's it. I don't know. Look, Laduca's got a sketchy history to begin with. But he made the whole thing up. The dude never worked a game in which Wagner and Laduca were in the game at the same time. $500,000 actually doesn't seem like that much for that story. All right. I wanted to get to, in more detail, something that I talked about yesterday morning, and I didn't have time to really get into it to the level of detail that I wanted to get into it. But I think it's really one of the more well-written and riveting stories of the last couple of weeks, or maybe even the last couple of months. It's the story in The Athletic written by Sheil Kapadia, Bo Wolf, and Zach Berman on the dysfunction in the Philadelphia Eagles organization. There were two specific stories that I shared yesterday from the story, and there were two that I did not. And I wanted to get to those other two because I think they are fascinating and there are very, very much similarities in so many ways to what's happened here and also what's happened in a movie previously. The Eagles are in utter disarray. At the same moment, at the same time, you can talk about the Eagles and you can say they've also been the winningest organization in the division since Jeffrey Lurie purchased the team back in the late 90s. More on that when we come back. Then I'll get to Sammys Reyes, the tight end that many of you, like with Thaddeus Moss, have already advanced into the Rookie of the Year conversation and have already put into the starting lineup. I learned a lot from not watching his pro day, but from watching a lot of basketball video with Reyes and comparing it to other great tight ends and their basketball careers. We'll do that a little bit.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
All right, football fans, the NFL Draft is almost here, and the free Odyssey app brings you the latest coverage from the biggest sports radio stations across the country. Which players will help your team the most? Who will make a draft day trade? Will they be ready for week one? The local conversations about the team you love. All streaming free right here on the Odyssey app. A-U-D-A-C-Y. Download it today.
Later on in the hour, and then we'll get back to the Kuiper draft board in more detail. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980, Team980.com.
Kevin Sheehan on the Team 980 and the Odyssey app.
Are you ready?
I want to make one thing clear here, that this is not a conversation really from my standpoint. I mean, you can draw the comparisons, but I'm really not relishing in the Eagles' dysfunction right now, because the bigger point when it comes to the Philadelphia Eagles is they may be in utter turmoil right now. They may have a very dysfunctional situation, but somehow, unlike Washington over a 21-year period, they've been able to overcome that dysfunction. They've won over and over again. They've won a Super Bowl. In the last 4 years, they've not only won playoff games in a Super Bowl, they were close to making the NFC Championship game in 2018, and they were back in the playoffs as a division champion in 2019. You know, the first real disastrous season they've had in the last 9 years was last year. Other than that, they've been competitive in most of the seasons. I mean, even their worst seasons were 7-9. They've been a much more successful organization than Washington. Jeffrey Lurie's been a much more successful owner than Dan Snyder. It's not comparable. So I'm not sitting here trying to bring up this story because somehow Philadelphia has reached Washington status. Okay, they'd have to go several years of rock bottom, last place, and, you know, a lot more than just football-related issues, right? Because the story in The Athletic, which is really one of the more riveting stories I've read in a long time, it was so well-researched, so well-written, so well-done by Sheil Kapadia, Bo Wolf, Zach Berman. We've had Zach on the show before. He covers the Eagles for The Athletic. It's so interesting on so many levels, but I want to make another thing clear, is that it's all football operation related. Washington's had an issue in almost every single, you know, corner of their operation. Obviously, there's no accusations of a culture of misogyny and sexual harassment, etc. This is all about the football operation. But I mentioned to you yesterday, in sort of a shortened version of the story, that Jeffrey Lurie is hyper-involved in the football operation. Howie Roseman is still there as the team's general manager, despite basically every media member and many fans wondering how the hell he survived and Doug Peterson and Carson Wentz did not. It's a story that includes two different sections that I wanted to pull from, but there are five or six revelations in this story that make it almost worthwhile to, you know, at least find somebody that could copy and paste it for you. But I'd subscribe because it's inexpensive, and it seems like there are three of these stories a week. But this is one of the best ones I've read in a while. I wanted to read from two different sections of this particular story. The first one goes as follows. Shortly after Jeffrey Lurie bought the team from Norman Brayman in 1994, Sports Illustrated's Peter King wrote, "Hollywood producer Jeffrey Lurie is a member of the most rabid subspecies of NFL fanatic, the draftaholic. In recent years, he has prepared for the league's annual college draft by holing up in the media room above the garage of his Beverly Hills home and watching tapes of the blue-gray game, the Japan Bowl, the Senior Bowl. Lurie would have them all on his big-screen surround sound TV. That passion remains strong today. According to multiple sources, Lurie devours tape of college prospects and is an active participant in the pre-draft process. Those who have experienced that process acknowledge its murkiness. Often there's no explanation given when the team strays from an established draft board. Sometimes, as with J.J. Arcega-Whiteside's selection in 2019, Lurie puts his thumb on the scale when the team was prepared to make another selection. In that case, Ohio State's Paris Campbell." Sound familiar? But the virtual nature of the 2020 draft made things even less clear to the majority of the football operations staff. For the most part, last year's decisions were discussed in small virtual rooms consisting of Roseman, Lurie, Peterson, and Vice President of Player Personnel Andy Weidel. As a result, each of the Eagles' first three selections, TCU receiver Jalen Reagor, who, if you recall, by the way, was taken one pick ahead of Justin Jefferson, Oklahoma quarterback Jalen Hurts and Colorado linebacker Davion Taylor, mystified some scouts and coaches watching along at home, just like everybody else. Roseman apparently has the final say over the roster. Any draft pick trade or signing, good or bad, is on his record. Yet behind the scenes, there's lingering ambiguity about how decisions are made. For an organization that publicly touts collaboration as if it's offering a TED talk on intra-office cohesion, the lack of collaboration became a common refrain among those with knowledge of the decision-making process. Coaches wanted their evaluations taken into account or felt like certain players were forced upon them. Scouts didn't understand why picks didn't correspond with an established methodology, and other staffers were unsure how their analysis was being applied in decisions. Departments became siloed or even pitted against each other, and the lack of collaboration made finger-pointing easier. Building that coalition and leading that group to work together in a constructive way is not how we strengthen, one source said. In fact, it's one of his weaknesses. Roseman is known to keep his own draft board, and scouts who spend months on the road evaluating players can feel marginalized when the rankings they've helped assemble are not followed. One source described Roseman pushing an assistant coach to give playing time to a recent draft pick while the assistant balanced conflicting recommendations from senior members of the coaching staff. Lurie, who regularly attends practice, inquired about a reserve's playing time. There's been confusion about why certain players were active and others were inactive on game days, with speculation centered on Roseman's outsized influence on the game day roster. These are the types of things that happen where there's no collaboration. This was Hall of Famer Brian Dawkins, who worked in the front office from 2016 to 2018. He once delivered an impassioned speech in the team's draft room to a group of employees in football operations. For those who had never seen that side of Dawkins up close, they claimed it was a stirring experience. With trademark intensity, the franchise icon spoke about his passion for the organization and addressed an office culture he said it needed more teamwork and less infighting. This is so reminiscent of what's gone on here. It gets better and even closer as I read from the rest of this particular section. No one in the organization has drawn more fan ire than Roseman. After all, if the head coach and quarterback who led the team to a Super Bowl 3 years ago can both be jettisoned so quickly, Peterson and Wentz, even though Wentz wasn't the starting quarterback in the Super Bowl, but he was the starting quarterback as they started off that season. What did they start that season off? 11-1? Something like that, Brendan, before he got hurt in the Coliseum. Whatever it was, and then Foles came in. Anyway, Fan ire for Roseman has gotten to such a level, and they want to know why the man responsible for hiring and acquiring both of those guys gets to stick around while those guys essentially are out. To think 3 years later, the head coach, your starting quarterback, who was the 2017 MVP caliber guy, the guy who won you the Super Bowl and damn near every coach, so they are referring to Foles there, who was on the staff, isn't here. You know, but Roseman is. What happened? Well, according to multiple sources, the answer is that Roseman has made himself essential to Lurie. He's the survivor, one source said about Roseman. This is someone who understands how to stay close with the most important person in the building. If that's not a description of 10 years of Bruce and Dan, I don't know what is. Roseman has had to overcome doubts about his football bona fides, which, by the way, is, you know, the same thing that Bruce Allen's had to overcome, right? He was a powerful executive in the league, but he wasn't known for his football acumen. Jeffrey Lurie basically has Howie Roseman around to deflect the blame, to take the blame, to take the hit for a lot of his decisions. This is essentially what this story leads to, is Lurie comes in and makes a lot of decisions, and then Roseman takes the heat for it. There's another part of this story that I wanted to read, and to me, this is really probably not the only organization in which this is an issue right now. You know, the Philadelphia Eagles have been known here in recent years as a very progressive organization. You know, embracing analytics, you know, having an analytics department. Well, it's created quite the internal confrontational strife. And this particular section of the story describes it. I hope this is interesting to all of you. I'm sitting here and I'm reading from it. It was very interesting and riveting to me. You read the story, right, Brendan?
Yeah, I found it fascinating. To me, it came off as like Jeff Lurie being like, wanting to be Jerry Jones so bad. He just wants to be in on the decisions. He wants to have his hand in everything. And the meetings he was having with Doug Peterson that you talked about yesterday, questioning him about running the football, even though it was like 27 mile per hour winds. I just found it all fascinating.
Yeah, that was the opening to the story yesterday, where basically, Doug Peterson had a weekly standing Tuesday meeting with Lurie and Roseman, and it was basically Lurie, you know, grilling Peterson on in-game coaching decisions. By the way, I want to make this point, too. He's the owner of the team. He has the right to do this. Owners, you know, are all different. They're all involved to a certain degree. Jeffrey Lurie, if you read through this story, sounds like a guy that would be on the level of fan that some of you and Brendan and I think we are, which is, you know, we're fans, but we have a real understanding of the game, not at an expert level, not at a coaching level, not, you know, anywhere near the level of the people that do this professionally. But Jeffrey Lurie isn't Dan Snyder, who's wearing a belt buckle and socks up to his knees, burgundy and gold socks. But really, if you've listened to Dan at any point during his 21 years, have any conversation about football, you can tell he really doesn't know much about football. And I think we've all in the media been told that this is not a guy that really understands what he's watching when he's watching it. Jeffrey Lurie apparently does. But the meetings, as Brendan just referred to, included Lurie and Roseman questioning Peterson about game management, fourth down decision making, play calling, personnel choices. And they questioned why they didn't throw the ball more. And this was in the game against Green Bay, where they came back from 10-0 down to beat the Packers 34-27 in 2019 to even up their record at 2-2. And basically, you know, Doug Peterson's answer was, we went to the running game because they basically were playing nickel, and we ran it down their throats. But that wasn't apparently good enough for Lurie, who wanted, you know, the use of analytics in some of the decision making, which would have led to more passing play suggestions. Anyway, the other part of this story that I wanted to read that I found really fascinating was this. And this will take a minute and a half to read, I think. Over time, the Tuesday meetings wore on Peterson. Lurie has long considered the organization at the forefront of innovation, and the impression among Peterson's supporters in the building was that Lurie's weekly questions were largely based on post-game reports produced by the team's analytics staff. Sources say Peterson was beaten down by the constant second-guessing. They treated him like a baby, one source said. Alec Hallaby, the Eagles' vice president of football operations and strategy, has worked under Roseman since joining the team full-time in 2010 and now runs the team's four-person analytics department. The young executive with an Ivy League pedigree carries with him the kind of reputation that causes football lifers to scoff. And according to multiple sources, a rift grew between Hallaby and some members of the coaching staff and scouting department. Quote, within the building, he's perceived as Howie's guy, one source said. That's a problem. No coach wants somebody around who they think is undermining the perception of how well they're doing. To some, Hallaby is something of an interloper. They say he carries influence with Lurie in part because of a close relationship with fellow Harvard grad Julian Lurie, Jeffrey's son, who stands to one day take over the family business. To others, Hallaby is brilliant and simply willing to fight for what he believes is right. The more nuanced opinion is that Hallaby is in a no-win situation, boxed into a specific characterization by the non-traditional football background he shares with Roseman and a personality that makes him a square peg in a round hole. The blurriness of Hallaby's influence on the final decision-makers creates rifts throughout the organization and has contributed to the iciness between departments. One source described the analytics team as clandestine black ops department style that doesn't answer to anybody except the owner, even though Hallaby officially reports to Roseman, which gets back to the initial thing that I read, which is Roseman essentially is the intermediary. He takes all the blame, but it's Lurie's mind and hands that are all over this thing. During the 2017 season, okay, which, by the way, turned out to be their Super Bowl season, Hallaby's and Peterson's relationship soured to the point where Peterson berated Hallaby within earshot of the rest of the office, according to sources. In the opinion of some members of the coaching staff, Hallaby was not to be trusted. Frustration mounted on the scouting side as well. Rather than the analytics, and now I'm going to paraphrase so I can get through the rest of it, rather than the analytics department presenting their draft reports with data, they just gave a list. So it was like they walked in, they plopped down a list and said, here are the players that the analytics department likes, without any explanation as to why. By the way, Jeffrey Lurie, he is invested in analytics. In addition to having this staff of analytics people, he purchased a stake in Warren Sharp of sharpfootballanalysis.com. Now, I'll be honest with you. I'm very familiar with some of these, like Pro Football Focus and others, and I've heard Warren Sharp's name many times. I'm not familiar with his product. Are you, Brendan?
Yeah, he's like really super smart. He put out the Sharp Football Report that comes out like before the season every year. Mm-hmm. And I used to get that all the time. I didn't get it last year, unfortunately. But he's got like a really good staff of football minds on his Sharp Football Analysis. He also does betting and fantasy content.
I knew the betting thing, and I want to say that that's where he started many years ago.
Yeah, it is.
As a bit of a tout, right? He was
No. Well, kind of, but not really. Like, it's not like he was doing like the the phone scammer,
the 900 numbers,
right? He just has like a history of like very good betting, and then he started going on more and more podcasts and talking about how all of this stuff and some of the bets he liked, but he was never doing like a tout service, I don't think.
By the way, something just which would be obvious to some of you that I've learned many years, mostly because of my familiarity with some of the offshore operations. When somebody, goes public with how good they are in betting on football, they weren't very good at betting on football because they would continue to do that. It's much more lucrative. Anyway, he would provide a weekly offensive game plan report to Lurie during the season. Lurie was an investor and an owner. It does not describe whether or not he was a majority equity holder or just a minority investor, but he would get this report from Warren Sharp and each week. Andrew Berry was hired by Roseman in 2019 as the VP of football operations. There was expectation by some in the building that he was brought in to help bridge the divide between the football side and the analytics department. But while Berry remains a popular figure in the organization and was described as one source as the nicest guy in the world, the damage between departments, analytics and football, was already done. The inner office dynamics were no more harmonious when Berry left to become the Browns GM in 2020. Before the 2018 draft, the Eagles installed a state-of-the-art draft room across the building from what is traditionally considered the football side of the building, where the coaching staff and scouting department sit. 1 year later, Hallaby's department was moved from the football side to the other side near the new draft room. Though Hallaby maintained his influence, the symbolism of Roseman banishing an entire department to the other side of the building was not lost on those who watched Roseman undergo the same move 3 years prior when Lurie had cast him aside in favor of Chip Kelly. The whole analytics thing, to me, is Moneyball. It is Brad Pitt, Jonah Hill, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, playing Billy Bean, Peter Brand, and Art Howe. It's Art Howe going, and by the way, all the other scouts, all the other football scouts, looking at Billy Bean and Peter Brand. Who's this guy? Peter, introduce yourself. Peter's here to help make decisions, and everybody looking at Peter, who was out of Yale. Where did he go to school? Yale, whatever. Peter Brand was was part of Paul Podesta's group, I think it was. Whatever. It's that whole situation of football lifers against the new analytics guys. Again. Getting back to it, this story is compelling in so many ways because it speaks to an owner that is hyper-involved, micromanages, and is everything that we've thought our owner to be, but it's really not true. Snyder's influence has been much more destructive, in part because he doesn't know anything, and because of the relationships that he's gotten in the middle of, whether it was RG3 with the Shanahans or whether, you know, it was coming in and demanding that a player that had gone to the same high school as his son be drafted ahead of people that were much higher on the team's board. Those kinds of things have been more destructive. I don't think, and I've never heard, of Dan Snyder calling a Tuesday meeting to ask why they went for the 4th and 5. I don't even think he understands that level of football. But the overarching theme to this is that Philadelphia right now has a major problem. They hired Nick Sirianni, and there is a line at the end of the story that Sirianni is essentially being hired, for all intents and purposes, as a puppet. And I'm looking for that specific part of the story because I want to read it. I'll find it here in a second. Here it is. In a phone call offering Sirianni, by the way, who was hired, he was the offensive coordinator in Indianapolis for Frank Reich. The Eagles got off to a late start, if you recall, because they hired fired Peterson a little bit late. You know, after they made Peterson tank the game, which they did for a better draft position against Washington, that was a tank. That was an absolute tanking, putting in Sudfeld for Jalen Hurts, who, you know, again, I don't subscribe to the theory that Philadelphia would have won the game had they left Hurts in. That's not the point. The point is that Philadelphia didn't want to win the game, and they did their best to ensure that they didn't by putting Nate Sudfeld into the game. But they ended up firing Peterson after Peterson refused to fire coaches on his staff. They were planning on doing this anyway. They had 25 candidates pared down to 10 for interviews. Sirianni was not considered a front runner for the job. In fact, Sirianni didn't interview anywhere else in 2021. Was not among the initial wave of Philadelphia Eagles interviewees. Lurie offered him the job anyway, and in a phone call offering Sirianni the job, he said he was so excited for the coach, and he said, I'm so excited for the coach you are and the coach you can become. But outside perception lingers that Sirianni offered the Eagles a coach of least resistance for management's involvement. The same was said about Peterson 5 years ago. So they hired a puppet coach. Doesn't mean that he's not going to be a good coach, but they hired a coach so they could continue to be significantly involved. Last point on this is that whatever Jeffrey Lurie's been doing since 1994 has worked. The Eagles have been the most successful team wins-wise, division title-wise, in the division. Now, they had a phenomenal coach for many years in Andy Reid. You know, and then they made the mistake with Chip Kelly, you know, a significant, you know, analytics hire for all intents and purposes made by Lurie. And Lurie loved Kelly and hated to move on from Kelly. They hired Peterson because he came from Andy Reid. But the bottom line is, they've been very successful, but maybe we're seeing the beginning of a troubling run for them. When you think about it, they won that Super Bowl, and they won that Super Bowl the year that they barely got out of the playoffs. You know, they barely got out of that game with the Falcons that year. Very lucky to get through that game against the Falcons that year, right? The Falcons was the game where Julio Jones was wide open and they just missed him at 10-6 or whatever in the postseason that year. I think that was the game. Was it 10-6? Here it is, 15-10. But they had a chance to win that game late, and they would have never made the Super Bowl. Anyway, I thought it was an interesting conversation. The conversation I want to have next is about Samis Reyes, the tight end that Washington signed that apparently has tested off the charts at an athletic level never seen for a tight end entering the NFL. We'll discuss that next. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980, team980.com, also on the Odyssey app.
Here's what's trending on the Team 980.
All right, the Caps debuted Anthony Mantha, the man they traded for the day before. He had a goal and an assist in the Caps' rout of Philadelphia 6-1. The Caps have outscored their last two opponents 14-2. The win puts the Caps 2 points up on the Islanders in the East Division, although the Islanders do have a game in hand. Steven Strasburg had the third and fifth innings get away from him, and then the game got away from the Nats. They got blown out in St. Louis 14-3. Nats fall to 2-6. There was a video, St. Louis's broadcast caught a video of Strasburg rubbing his pitching shoulder in the tunnel shortly before being pulled. Nats face the Cardinals today, 1:15 first pitch. Joe Ross opposite Adam Wainwright. We're going to talk about Washington football team signing a former Tulane basketball player, Samis Reyes. We'll get to that next. Other NFL news, 22 of the 24 women that have brought lawsuits against Deshaun Watson will be identified. Meantime, former Steelers running back James Conner gets a one-year deal in Arizona. Denver, Tampa, and Seattle players all have voted to skip in-person voluntary workouts this spring. All right, let's get to the news that was making Washington football team fan rounds yesterday, and that was the signing of Samis Reyes, who had played basketball at Tulane for 2 years, not very impressively. I'll get to that here in a moment. Reyes has been training at IMG, the big sports academy in Florida, as part of the International Pathway Program. I was unfamiliar with this. Participants in this program get assigned to a random division, and those teams could then pick one player from a pool of 11 athletes. After Reyes worked out at the University of Florida's Pro Day on March 31st and apparently killed it athletically, Washington decided to sign him so no one else would have a shot. He is 6'6", he's 260 pounds, he ran a 4.65 40, he bench pressed 225 pounds 31 times. He's never played in a football game, despite coaches in high school and college telling him that he should try football. His dream when he moved from Chile to the United States in Florida was to play in the NBA. In his high school senior year, he tried football for a week and then quit. He played two basketball seasons at Tulane, appeared in 32 games. He averaged 0.8 points and 1.5 rebounds per game. He had played one season at Palm Beach State Junior College for basketball. He's 25 years old, by the way. The basketball career ended in 2018. He's been working out in Virginia with a trainer. And said his agent said that multiple teams wanted to sign Reyes, but that Washington was the first one to pursue him. Tabitha Plummer, his agent, and Reyes liked how other tight ends have developed under Coach Ron Rivera and Pete Hayner, the tight ends coach. Obviously, that would include Logan Thomas here and Greg Olson in Carolina. All right. This was Scott Pioli, longtime NFL general manager, who works as part of this international pathway program. This was him talking about Sammys Reyes.
Scott, tell me about Reyes here, because DJ even pointed to the screen, Daniel Jeremiah, going, who is that guy?
Well, Andrew, you know, what happens is the NFL started a program a couple of years ago called the International Player Pathways. And what we do every year is identify, evaluate, select players to go to IMG Academy and train for a couple of weeks. Did that again this year. This year, Coach Dan Mullen from Florida was so kind to let the 11 players come out and be a part of this pro day. And as you mentioned, the guy that showed out today is Sammys Reyes from Chile. Fascinating background. He grew up in Chile, played basketball, was an international AAU player, came to the United States on his own. And again, his background is just incredible. Ended up going to Tulane after 2 years of junior college, playing NCAA basketball, being a very good player. Came in today, measured at 6.053, 260 pounds. Vertical jumped 40 inches, Andrew. 31 reps on the bench and ran a 4.65. Had a tremendous day. Now, here's the thing, Andrew. I've been down there watching and working with these players a couple of times this spring and while they've been down there. And there's a number of really, really interesting players that can develop and I think will be NFL players. We've seen basketball players in the past that have come into the NFL, developed, trained, and become pretty good NFL tight ends.
So that was Scott Pioli talking about Sammys Reyes. We've seen a lot of basketball players who have come into the NFL over the years and excelled. You know, Antonio Gates, Jimmy Graham, Julius Peppers, who played on defense. A lot of these guys end up playing tight end. Darren Fells in recent years. Tony Gonzalez, a Hall of Fame tight end. Mo Alie-Cox, who played at VCU and now plays tight end in Indianapolis. Who am I forgetting? Jimmy Graham, I mentioned. Tony Gonzalez, Gates. Yeah, and Peppers. Those are the guys, by the way, I went back and looked at. You can find other guys like Julius Thomas and Rico Gathers and other players. But the guys that ended up being pretty good NFL players, and specifically the tight ends. And what I did, Brendan, is I went back and looked at a lot of basketball video. Now, there is some basketball video on Sammys Reyes. But there's not a lot, because the truth is he didn't really play much at Tulane. In 2016-2017, he played in 30 games. He started two. He averaged 8.2 minutes per game, and he averaged 0.8 points per game, barely even averaged a half a block, averaged 0.3 assists and 1.5 rebounds. Now, you know, only 8 minutes a game. And I wanted to see what he looked like playing basketball, because I remember Tony Gonzalez as a basketball player at Cal. I remember Gates as a basketball player at Kent State. They made it to the Elite Eight that year. Jimmy Graham at Miami, I remember Jimmy Graham. Mo Alie-Cox, not as much at VCU, but I went back and watched a lot of video of all of these really good basketball to football tight ends specifically and what they looked like as basketball players. And then I also watched as much video as existed on Sammys Reyes as a basketball player at Tulane. Why did I do that? Because I think you can learn a lot from watching somebody play basketball. Basketball players, to me, are the best all-around athletes, and they're the athletes that can play almost anything. Now, there are examples of guys that aren't super coordinated, but they're big and strong and athletic, and that's why they're out there. But they're not great basketball players. And yet they're able to play at that level. But I'm really talking about the majority of basketball players, where basketball requires, you know, maybe soccer is an argument. We've gotten into this in years past. But I think basketball requires the most hand-eye, foot-eye, every kind of coordination possible. You have to be a vision athlete. You have to be a spatial kind of athlete. There's just too much that goes into basketball. You know, at a young age for kids, it's very easy to throw a soccer ball out into the field and have kids run around, and you really can't tell the difference. Look, there's always two or three kids out there that you can see. They're aggressive, they're athletic, and usually at a very young age, it's the kids that are very confident and aggressive that get the results. But you can also see the skill. But you can get lost as a non-athlete, as a kid, on a soccer field. You can't on a basketball court. It's very hard to lose yourself. It's very hard to not be able to identify that person doesn't have the requisite coordination to play the sport. So I went back and looked at a lot of basketball video of all of the guys that have been good NFL players at the tight end position, and then I looked at Sam East Reyes to see what kind of all-around athlete he was. And I'll tell you what I found out when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980, Team980.com.